This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and there are few documents more political than government budgets. We're getting the Ontario budget later this afternoon, as you've been hearing here all morning, and there will be few surprises, if any. The government has told us or leaked some of the key provisions, and the key theme is affordability. They're promising no new taxes, and an extension of the 5.7 cent a liter gas tax cut. And we have some unspecified changes to auto insurance, which would allow consumers to tailor their coverage in order to pay less, something I think everyone should be very careful about. Meanwhile, in Ottawa, the carbon tax will kick in next week, adding 3 cents a liter to the cost of gas, and that would be canceling most of the provincial break, but setting up the political divide between the progressive conservatives here in Ontario and the federal liberals. So what do you think? Are those the things that you think will make life more affordable for you? And not expecting much for older Canadians or for healthcare there. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome former Ontario NDP MPP Sherry DeNovo, former Liberal Cabinet Minister George Smitherman, and former Ontario PC MPP and Finance Minister Janet Ecker. Hi, everyone. Thanks for Hello. Joining us.
Pleasure, Libby.
Good day.
Okay, let us begin with Janet, your former finance minister. This is a progressive conservative government. Do you think that they are striking the right note, at least in what they've been telling us so far?
Well, I think so, Libby. I mean, this is a budget that's sort of midterm in the government's life, so it's usually not launching grand new initiatives. I think they're going to stick to their knitting and can move forward with some of the initiatives they've already rolled out. And that, the infrastructure spend, I think I've always liked to joke that he who boils it down to a bumper sticker first wins, and that get it done has been a catchphrase. And I think you're going to see a continued push on infrastructure in this budget, because that's something that helps, you know, it's an important support for the economy. The second thing I think you're going to see is paying attention to the affordability issues that consumers are facing out there, whether it's the extension of, on the gas tax, as you mentioned, whether it's savings on auto insurance. I think they're going to constantly be looking for a way to help consumers with the prices that are, you know, the inflation and that we've been coping with. But I think the third thing you're going to see is, I mean, this is a finance minister who was a risk management professional during his career. And so I think you're going to see a lot of flexibility in that budget. He likes big contingency funds, and he certainly needed them with some of the court settlements we've seen over Indigenous relations and the employment, cancellation of Bill 124.
Yeah, that's kind of the elephant in the budget. It affects all kinds of things, because that settlement is going to be in the billions. But George, Janet was just talking about infrastructure and the focus on infrastructure. So I have a couple of questions. First of all, there are so many things going on at once. Are there enough actual workers for all these projects? And we have just started to see the huge headache increases. It seems like everything is blocked all at once. Is there going to be any blowback because of that? You know, on the one hand, they're saying we're building highways, but in the meantime, trying to get anywhere in this city is just a nightmare.
Well, I think that I sense some blowback from a variety of people who are in neighborhoods where stations for the Ontario line is significantly starting to disrupt, with neighborhoods and plazas being taken out of play and all that. I went to the finance minister's speech last week, and I was struck by how it was, I'd say, practically singularly focused on infrastructure, which finance ministers sometimes love because it's sort of one-time spending. But what I really see here is a government which is actually depriving itself of the resources that it needs to adequately operate the public services that it's responsible for. So while I do think that they will talk about affordability and extending gas tax cuts, I do think that they will talk about infrastructure, and they're definitely spending. I think that they will, the not so hidden story will be the extent to which operating services that the government is responsible for are being deprived of the resources to pay the actual people, like those Bill 124 settlements that include doctors who have not yet actually been factored into the economic mix.
Yeah, I mean, they have to pay all this extra money, and we'll be talking a little later in the show about the figure on the agency nurses, which is close to $1 billion. That's nurses and PSWs hired at double or triple the rates because there weren't enough people to work. And one of the things they say was they didn't get enough money or didn't get enough raises. And now, boy, those raises are coming. Sherry DeNovo, do you think they're learning a lesson from this?
I hope so. I mean, they're very good at losing court cases. I'll give them that. What really strikes, you know, the person in the street, I think, is all of a sudden something that we all Canadians hold dear, Medicare, is being attacked and privatized. The Financial Accountability Officer has said, you know, $21 billion less in the next 3 years being spent. You know, certainly transfers from the federal government to the tune of $70 billion. Where did that all go? We're seeing ads in our subways for private clinics where, you know, you have to pay $450 to register, where most Ontarians now almost, you know, are being shortchanged. Even if they have a doctor, can't get to see them. And the Canada Health Act, why is that not being upheld? You know, we're seeing all sorts of ridiculous spending, like $840 million for a spa in an Ontario place that should be public. And the infrastructure, like Highway 413, I mean, the blowback around that, I mean, that's, again, incursion into the Greenbelt. Farmers are upset, 2,000 acres of farmland going. I mean, the expenditures that they are making on infrastructure are not ones that we voted for, quite frankly. And, you know, again, things like education and healthcare that affect us all are being shortchanged.
Let's take a call from Sheila in Mississauga. Hello, Sheila.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I'd like to speak to the or tell the minister for finance, who's going to have a budget today. He is going to wear a new pair of shoes, yeah?
Well, and he's got work boots, apparently.
yeah. And it'll be paid by us, taxpayers. I need a new pair of shoes to walk. Okay, but cannot afford it.
Yeah.
So are we going to have any changes done, or they are just going to play the game of the rich?
You've been hearing what our panel is saying. It depends what you consider. If a cut extended in the gas tax helps you, if new infrastructure helps you, then they're on
if
your side.
If there is any cuts that helps me to buy grocery or buy anything and survive, yes, it makes sense. But up till now, I've never seen any sense. So,
well, yeah, I think a lot of people feel that way. Sheila, thank you very much for your call. On the other hand, we have the carbon tax coming in, the increase in the carbon tax on Monday, on Easter Monday, on April Fool's, as some people are calling it. Now, that's going to cancel out some of this extension of the gas tax cut, but it does set up quite the political divide, I think. Is that a good way to go in terms of messaging, George?
Well, it's the way they're going to go in terms of messaging. I'd say that it's a political construct that they like very much, but I think it runs the risk of missing the overall point. Gas prices go up and down constantly by 3 cents and 5 cents due to a variety of factors. And if the Canadian or Ontario public is capable of pointing to the price of gas and saying, oh, Doug's saving me 5 cents a liter or what have you, I'm very skeptical that that's actually successful. And I do hear the sensitivity about affordability. Obviously, that's on the minds of all politicians, including at the national level, where their advertising is focused on initiatives that are supposed to make the cost of life more affordable. But I rather do think that that governments run the risk of missing the key point, which is they're responsible to deliver essential services. And I think that there's tremendous pent-up challenges for this government related to their strategies on pricing the wages of the million or so broader public servants and, say, 500,000 people that work in the delivery of health care. We've seen some of those legal settlements, but we haven't, stemming from court cases, but we haven't seen the price tag associated with the catch-up expectation that's there on the part of doctors who are also captured in that Bill 124. And there's some tremendously troubling news out there about the state of primary care, with doctors leaving residency positions unfulfilled and a tremendous decline in number of physicians who consider themselves comprehensive family physicians. So the crisis is on in healthcare, and that usually is something that requires resources that I believe this government is depriving itself of.
Well, yeah, and there's also a shortage of education workers. Janet, do you think this government is fighting off those criticisms by handing out some goodies such as they are?
Well, I don't think this budget is going to be handing out goodies. I think this budget is going to be a little more serious than that and focusing on, as we said, key affordability issues and key issues that infrastructure issues which do support people getting to work, for example.
Not anytime soon, I might add.
But you can't do it soon. That's the problem. It's something that takes time, and that's why they started, and that's why they're pushing so hard on so many of these projects. George is right, there's neighborhood disruption, but that's been one of the excuses for not moving forward on a lot of that infrastructure that the city and the region and Ontario desperately needs. But the other infrastructure that they are paying attention to is that need for talent, particularly in healthcare. And we're not the only jurisdiction facing this, but as the minister in the clip you used before, talked about the $100 million, we'll see probably see additional money in the budget, I suspect, today for healthcare. They've been targeting PSWs, they've been targeting nurses, they've been targeting physicians to try and fill those gaps. Again, not easy, can't be done quickly, but it's on their priority list as it should be, because we do have serious challenges in our healthcare system. And also, too, to Sherry, we've always had a public-private mix in Canada, across the country, in every jurisdiction, and we need to continue to have that flexibility to get, because at the end of the day, people don't care whether it's, who pays for it. As long as they're not paying for it with their Visa card, they can pay for it with their OHIP card, and they know where they can get it. They want access, they want quality, they want to pay with their OHIP card, and that's exactly what the government is trying to deliver.
Well, yeah, they're paying with their OHIP card, except for certain kinds of allowable extra charges. I mean, what I found with people is that when they pay more, they don't understand what they're paying for. And I think that's the crux of the problem. But if you go to a clinic and you need to stay overnight and there's a charge for that, that can be a lot of money, Sherry.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're paying, as many of our seniors do, $5,000 to get your cataracts done within 2 weeks, and you have to wait for a $500 operation, which is what the public system calls it, for months, that's a difference, and that's a real problem, and that is a breach of our Canada Health Act.
Well, wait a minute.
Of course, cosmetic, surgery and things have always been privatized and probably should be. But what we're talking about here are people waiting just to, don't have a doctor, don't have a primary care physician. We're talking about a huge shortage of nurses and, as you said, Libby, $1 billion going to, so the nurses are there. They're just not being paid well enough in the public system to stay in the public system. And back to, Bill 124, this is ongoing and everywhere. And quite frankly, most people are going to be shocked when they're getting those bills that they didn't have to pay for before in healthcare. And of course, desperate people will pay. This is how you destroy public services. You underfund them so that they, can't provide what you need. And then you sell them off on 5 cents of the dollar to your friends, your political friends. And then you really get charged for them. And what we're moving towards is the American system. And trust me, it doesn't work well. It's the most expensive healthcare system, one of them in the world. And a lot of people aren't covered at all.
Well, I just want to clarify because I'm looking into the situation with cataracts. I've had calls from people. So the way it works is that there is a certain type of surgery, a certain lens that's covered by OHIP, and they cannot charge for that type of lens. And that's kind of, if you want to upgrade, it is whatever the upgrade is minus that kind of lens. As I said, I think part of the problem is that people get scared. It's my eyes. And I haven't been in a room where they're upsold or whatever. But even in a hospital, you have an option to upgrade. The problem is that people don't really understand what they're paying for, if they need it, because not everybody needs it. That's a big problem.
The upsell on the lens is an unconscionable act, and the College of Physicians and Surgeons is the accountable body to hold the ophthalmologists that are involved in that game to accountability. But what shouldn't be lost here is that the government decided to outsource the responsibility for doing more of these surgeries to private clinics, and they pay more per unit for those with the OHIP card that Janet spoke about than the public system would actually provide them for, like the Kensington Clinic on College Street that our government mandated. So I think that it's really, really critical to recognize here that we're paying more for less in the government's rush to outsource public services to private delivery models. And the unconscionable upselling is something that's always been a risk there with ophthalmologists. My mother experienced it where they tried to tell her that her cataract lens that OHIP was paying for was some low standard lens, which it certainly is not. So I think there's two different issues at play there, each of which is a vulnerability for the Ontario taxpayer.
Okay. By the way, people, just hang on. We will get to your calls. A little bit of patience. Stay on the line and we will get to it. People getting impatient. I'm just saying, hang on the line and we'll get to your calls. And that's the problem with cataracts as an example. Some of it is unconscionable, and some of it is not. Some of it, it's either a choice for people or depending on what exactly their eye condition is. And again, there's an option of upgrading even if you go to a hospital. So I'm planning to look into this further. But it is an area that is, I think, really quite problematic. Even though the impetus is, well, people are waiting too long for their cataract surgery and we need to help them get it done. Again, there's not much for healthcare in this. We're expecting an announcement of a new university, a new medical school in Vaughan. But when you look at the numbers of people going into family practice, I don't think that a new medical school is going to convince them to go into family practice. And this is something I'm going to take up with our medical panel tomorrow. But, you know, they're going to medical school and then choosing different specialties, Janet. So how do you tackle that?
No, and that has been one of the challenges. And I think the government is very focused on that. They understand that challenge. And you can't mandate somebody to be a family physician. You have to make it worth their while, and you have to make it a productive, you know, like a good quality of work life, if you will. And there's a number of projects that are going on, working with the OMA, working with the Canadian Medical Association, to try and remove some of the, for example, the administrative burden that physicians have is quite serious. It takes up a lot of their time that it shouldn't be taking up their time, that time they could be spending with patients. So the government is quite recognizes the challenge. And, you know, I got to tell you, and I don't think that Sherry was part of this, but, you know, the NDP government actually way back when actually cut the number of doctors that we could produce by over 10%. And when you look at how long it takes to train a doctor, steps like that can really undermine your system. So the government's trying to produce more opportunities for physicians and more opportunities for family physicians, because you're absolutely right. We need them in the system. But the other thing that we need that the government is moving forward on is health teams, so that you don't have a physician in solo practice, which was the old practice, but continuing to expand. What, George, you don't like teams? Your government did a lot of the teams.
We did the teams. I had to mop up after your government, Janet, which... Honestly, when we came in 2003, it was the same as now. After conservative rule, family physicians aren't interested in being family physicians. The residency positions go unfilled. We significantly increased the size of medical schools, but the thing about it is that if you look at the current doctors that are licensed to practice in Ontario, they're giving up on family practice because Ontario does not have a competitive model for today's physician. And this recent tiny announcement of $110 million after freezing family health teams for a decade is a pittance. It's a mere pittance. So to talk about the conservatives are doing this and that with the OMA, no. Since 2018, they've run down family practice in Ontario to the point that residency position go unfulfilled significantly, and a huge fall off in the number of doctors wishing to be comprehensive family physicians, because the model is not a competitive model. And this government doesn't have the resources to put their money where their mouth is, because they're too busy giving it away in trinkets.
Well, you know what, George, I would probably agree with you, but the way that people who are graduated in family medicine practice is different now. It's different. They aren't prepared to work 60-hour weeks like their dads did. And there was a study just out yesterday that even male doctors are cutting back so they can have some kind of work-life balance. We've seen a lot of family physicians that spend part of their time in certain specialties. And I think that's probably a generational thing, and can't entirely be fixed by government, Sherry.
Well, I mean, it's not just healthcare. I know we focus a lot on healthcare, where there's serious cuts. I mean, they're just not spending the money that's being transferred to them from the federal government. So that's right off the bat, and that's in the billions, according to the Financial Accountability Officer, $21 billion for a few years. So there's that. But they're also underfunding education, you know, over 3 years. So this is a general policy to underfund all social services and to put the money instead into what could arguably be, you know, not what they were elected to do, big mega projects like Highway 413 and things that we never voted for, like spas on, you know, on a Terry Place. So, I mean, this to me and to a lot of people is taking away what we really need, education and healthcare, and giving us what we don't. You know, that's a problem. And I think that's going to come home to roost.
Janet, I think we have to let you respond to all this.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, Sherry, I'm glad you don't have to worry about getting to work in this region. But there are many, many people out there that need transit, they need roads, they need ways to get to jobs. That is an economic infrastructure. That's not a goodie, that's not a giveaway, that's a fundamental investment in the economic future of this province so we can continue to afford healthcare and education. And, you know, I love this conspiracy theory that somehow or other, the government who have families, who have people out there who work in healthcare, who use healthcare, that somehow or other there's this great plot that we're going to give it all to the private sector. It's absolute balderdash. There's always been a public-private mix in healthcare. There always will be. And jurisdictions who get that mix right, and a lot of them around the countries, are doing better than we are because we haven't got that mix right yet. And it's not because we're handing it away, you know, in goodies. It's because there's a lot of fundamental change and reform that the government is pushing forward on. And it's not easy. And as the comments that George just made about, you know, years ago, you're absolutely right. We've been fighting these challenges for a lot of years, but they're focused on the right things. And we will see, I think, more of that in this budget because there is more for health. There is more for education, as there should be, and there's more for the infrastructure that we desperately need to keep this economy functioning.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. Boy, I think that we've really set up basically an ideological divide here, and I guess it depends on what the people of Ontario think and what they will think at the next election, but I'm going to give George and Sherry each 30 seconds to wrap things up. George, you go first.
Oh, just to go back to the point I was on to, in 2004 to 2008 period, we adopted family health teams. 3 million people in Ontario get their care from family health teams. And we attached 1 million people to care that did not have it. And governments since then, including Liberal governments of Kathleen Wynne, were not investing in the family health team model. But that still stands as an alternative that could reverse the tide of people losing access to comprehensive family care. But you have to pay the doctors appropriately. And Ontario has really created frequently a surge and starve model where they throw money at something for a short period of time and then they don't revisit it for a decade or what have you. And we're into a very serious crisis in primary care.
Okay. Sherry, 30 seconds, no more. I'm really out of time.
I know. All I'll say is Highway 407 to Janet. I mean, this was a huge mistake by the Conservatives, and now we're all paying for it. I mean, if we just owned the 407 and, this, we wouldn't be in this predicament.
Okay, everybody, the budget is coming just after 4 o'clock today, so we'll see what's actually in it and what it means to you. And in the meantime, boy, this was a bit of a brawl, but thank you so much, Janet Ecker, George Smitherman, and Sherry DeNovo, and we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Have a good day, guys.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, we are taking a break and continuing on the theme of healthcare. We're going to talk about that number we saw yesterday from Freedom of Information, nearly $1 billion on agency nurses and personal support workers. Why and what do we do about it when we come back?
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we are getting to that conversation we hinted at. And since the pandemic, we've heard a lot about the increasing use of expensive agency nurses and PSWs because of regular staff shortages. And now we have a number on it. The government spent nearly $1 billion on agency nurses and PSWs last year. And what are the consequences? And what can be done to decrease that number? And people, if you have anything to say about it or if you've had experience with that, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Lisa Levin, Chief Executive Officer of Advantage Ontario, which represents nonprofit long-term care, and Jane Midas, staff lawyer and institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly. Hello and welcome, and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Libby.
Good afternoon.
It's afternoon.
It's afternoon. So here's one question that I have. You know, the math looks staggering. It's two or three times the regular rate. However, from the point of view of the nurses, they don't get benefits. They don't get that gold-plated public sector pension. So I'm wondering that from the point of view of the workers and not the agency that gets a nice cut from that, is it really worth it from them for them? Lisa, what's your view of that?
Well, if we're talking about long-term care or home and community care, there often aren't gold-plated pensions unless they work, for example, for a municipal long-term care home. And so that's part of the issue. The salaries are lower in community care and long-term care than in hospitals. And also the morale has gone down because people see their colleagues leaving and going to work for a temporary agency, coming back sometimes the next day, back to work in the home, choosing the shifts they want and making more money.
So, Jane, in your experience, is it a matter that they get more, say, more agency if they work for an agency, or is it actually the money?
I wouldn't know why the staff are going. What I can tell you is that the effect on the residents and the care is quite a problem. Because these staff, you know, sure, some of these staff are leaving and going and coming back to the same home, but that's not the norm. They often are coming in, don't know anything about the residents, and use of agency staff has been a problem ever since I've been working with long-term care residents, and it's just increased where you have staff coming in who don't know the residents, don't know the rules of the home, et cetera, and it creates really big problems.
Well, I'm assuming that it's especially a big problem when you're dealing with people who have dementia. A lot of residents do have dementia, and they need kind of stability. And I would imagine that having different people all the time is especially difficult for them, Lisa.
It's absolutely a problem, Libby, because they can't necessarily make their needs known. And so it's much better to be able to provide care when you know the resident well, you're familiar with their care plan, and you know how to work best with them, as opposed to having a revolving door of staff coming and going. So we need to fix this, and we need to have a solution, because this can't go on. It's just not good for resident care. And also, long-term care is one of the most highly regulated sectors that there is, with 600 regulations and 1,000 requirements. So how are these temporary staff supposed to know how to meet all of those requirements and keep people safe and meet the rules of the government?
Jane, what kind of complaints, what kind of issues have you dealt with that involve people coming in from an agency? And does this apply to personal support workers coming from an agency?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people in long-term care, as you pointed out, many of them do have dementia, and so they don't know if something is being done incorrectly, like you or I might if we were, you know, in healthcare and see a wrong medication or something. So we certainly hear reports from our capable residents as well as from family members about incorrect medication being given, improper care, getting the wrong food, not being fed properly. So a person, you know, might need a certain kind of diet or have to, you know, have a choking issue. These staff, you know, are coming in. They don't know all about the ins and outs of these people that can be very complex and that require very specific kinds of care. They don't know if this person has a trauma that perhaps when they're being bathed, there's a certain issue or a certain way to provide that care. And frankly, they don't have the time to come in and read the files of all the residents that they're going to be having to be cared for. They're going to have to care for. So, you know, we have a huge problem. They are often not identified. So residents will ask them their name. They don't wear name tags. It's a huge problem. And the care is not good. And we really have to look at this. You know, people in long-term care, the staff are not paid properly. They never have been. They've always been the poor sisters of the younger, of the other sectors. And, you know, this has to change. Instead of spending $1 billion on agency staff, let's make sure that people are getting proper care. Let's make sure that they're getting pensions and that they're being treated properly and that the way that they should.
Okay, let's take a call from Rob in Scarborough. Hello, Rob.
Hi, hello there.
Go ahead.
I have first-hand experience. I have two nieces who are both nurses in hospitals, and what they have found is because of the government, the way they've been treated by the Ontario government, people have left. They go to an agency. They earn more money. They come back, and as you say, they do not know the patients. They do not know the protocols. And in one instance, one so-called qualified nurse turned to my niece and says, "What do I do?" And my niece was so frustrated, she said, "You're being paid the big bucks and twice as much as I am. You figure it out." And it was, she said it was one of those normal practices that every nurse knows how to do. But because of the way they've been treated, the Bill C-124, qualified nurses have left in droves. It would cost a lot less to pay nursing staff directly, including benefits, than it does to pay the exorbitant rates that are charged by the agencies.
Thank you, Rob, for that. That's an interesting story. Those are part of the problems, I guess, with the use of agency nurses. As an aside, and this is not relevant to this conversation, but in the last while, I have seen a couple of doctors who obviously never even had a glancing look at the file. And as a patient, and I'm pretty with it with my medical stuff, it's very frustrating. But Lisa, what can be done to fix this? We know that there's been a court decision, so people are going to get back pay, and it might hobble, actually, the government's ability to do other things.
So there's a number of things that need to be done. Firstly, the government has agreed to compensate homes, long-term care homes and hospitals, so that they can afford the wage reopeners that people asked for when Bill 124 ended. But they haven't provided the money yet for home and community care. So what we're seeing is, or what we need is an all of healthcare sector approach, where all healthcare workers, no matter where they work in the sector, if they do similar roles, they should be paid similar salaries. And that's not the case right now. So people go from home and community care or long-term care into hospitals because they can make more there. They need to have, they need to cap the agency rates in some way. And they also need to make sure that there's a licensing system with teeth that actually can prevent these agencies from sending in staff without the proper credentials, which is also happening in some cases. So they need to really look at the whole sector. And the other thing is the government has been spending a lot of money and spending a lot of time trying to improve the health human resources, but they often only focus on one profession. So, for example, the PSWs got a $3 increase per hour. But then the registered practical nurses that work at those PSWs now make the same or less than the PSWs in long-term care. So that has let created many registered practical nurses just like leaving the sector in droves, because it's just not fair. Or some of them are actually asking to be demoted to be PSW.
That's interesting. Jane, that fix, I mean, when I hear fixes that all revolve around cash, it makes me wonder, because there are other problems involved. But do you think those are the things that would fix the situation?
Well, we have to treat everyone similarly, and I agree. I think that there should be a across-the-board rate for nurses. It's very unfortunate that different governments across the time have not, paid nurses the proper attention and respect that they're due. They always seem to be the ones that are, given the wrong end of the stick. And we really need to understand that they are the backbone of our healthcare system, as are the PSWs in long-term care. And they have to be paid properly. working in long-term care is one of the poorest paid jobs in the healthcare sector, and yet it's some of the hardest work they have to do. And we really have to ensure that they're paid properly, have across-the-board wages and benefits so that everyone in the sector is feeling like they're properly compensated for the very hard work that they do.
Okay, Lisa, anything else you'd like to add to that as a fix?
Well, I think that we need to focus on all the workers, including physiotherapists, food service workers, recreationists, and all the different staff that work in long-term care. And we also can't forget about management, who haven't had an increase. And they have been dedicated working through the pandemic during very tough times. And we are seeing huge turnover in management in long-term care homes. So we need to look at everybody. And we also need to have special incentives in rural communities. We need to have housing for healthcare workers, transportation for healthcare workers, and higher amounts of pay and incentives so that people will go work in rural and northern communities.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lisa Levin and Jane Midas. Really appreciate your input. Bye-bye.
Bye, Libby.
Okay, another break. And when we come back, so we have talked so much about the high price of groceries. Well, there is an annual list that's come out. It's called the Dirty Dozen and the Green 15, and it's out of the States, where a lot of our produce is coming from at this season. And it details which ones have the highest levels of pesticides and which ones have the lowest levels. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Strawberries, spinach, kale, and grapes. Well, you probably assume you're buying really healthy food when you stock your fridge with those, but they are at the top of this year's Dirty Dozen list, and that is the Environmental Working Group's annual ranking of fruits and vegetables that contain the most and also the least pesticides. Now, the idea is to help us make choices on where to spend our money on organic produce, though at this point, all produce is expensive. So the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. What are you spending your money on, and are you aware of pesticide levels? And now I am joined by Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie, and Nicole Boudreau, who is a biologist with the Organic Federation of Canada. Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let us begin with Sylvain. So the list of the Dirty Dozen, strawberries, spinach, kale, grapes at the top, and blueberries are number 11. What do you make of this list? This is produce that was tested in the States, but that's where a lot of things come from at this point in the season.
Well, yes, absolutely. So when it comes to food prices and food affordability, obviously we need an efficient agriculture and higher yields. And the use of pesticides, for example, is critical. I don't know if you saw the story yesterday coming out of Quebec. Someone actually found a scorpion in bananas.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and the person was actually stung and had to go to the hospital. But the reason why we're seeing more of these things is the fact that, well, in Canada, we are expecting growers to use less insecticides and pesticides. And, of course, it's a rare occasion. I think we've seen scorpions three times in the last decade in Canada. But that's kind of the point I'm making, is that if we don't necessarily use chemicals, we grow organically, it's great, it's fine, but there are risks associated with that type of agriculture. And so we need to keep that in mind.
Okay, well, and one of the things that keeps people from buying organic is the price. But boy, the price of regular stuff, yesterday, I paid $6.99 for blueberries, and then I was really worried about the $2.99 strawberries, and they have pesticides, clearly, and they also weren't that good. Nicole, what about the price?
Well, what about the price? It is that if you consider, I will speak as a biologist, if you consider the potential impact of a long time exposure to pesticide year after year, and also when you consider the combined effect of pesticides together, because when they analyze the use of one pesticide, if it is very low, okay, it may be okay, but the combination of different pesticides together, it can induce a chemical symbiosis that would be hard to neutralize. So my point is not to make it horrible, but it is that the environmental cost and the health cost associated with long time use of ingestion of pesticides, it may be a lot, you know, more expensive to the society. So I know it is an overview of everything, but I would also say that as customers now, we want to see, you know, blueberries in January. We have developed sophisticated manners in our diet, and the transportation and the in intensive agriculture. So it is what consumers are demanding, industries trying to adapt. But from an organic perspective, I think that we need more research on pest control. As much money was spent on research on organic agriculture than it is on, let's say, conventional agriculture, maybe prices, pest control for organic producers would be more better, and it would become more affordable. I'm talking about the long term, middle long term solution, obviously. Yeah.
In the near term, Sylvain, what is how big is the differential between conventional and organic?
Yeah, I was going to say that is a really good question. Because of inflation, of course, for many years, we have seen consumers looking for bargains. It's even worse now, obviously, because of higher food prices. But what we notice at the lab is that the gap between, say, premium products, so including organically grown and produced food products, has narrowed as a result of food inflation, because everything is more expensive at the grocery store. If you look at, say, for example, farmers markets, where you do find a lot of organic products, the gap is much less significant. And so if people are looking for options,
we're losing you.
Or whatever they find at the grocery store is too expensive, and they want to say, well, might as well go for organic. That would probably be the best time to do it.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that. It depends what you're buying at what point, but sometimes the price is even the same. As I said, I was in a hurry, and I bought conventional blueberries for $6.99. That seems like a lot. Is there a way of washing the stuff that is going to take off pesticide? Because normally you rinse produce, but Dr. Charlebois, is that going to take pesticide off of something like grapes or strawberries?
Well, obviously you need to wash your produce as much as possible every time. Even if you go to the farmer's market, I think it's recommended that we all wash our produce before consumption, for sure, to reduce risks as much as possible. But I would say when you look at organic production in general, it is a much more simple model, and they are fewer, I would say, systemic risks. So in other words, if you're looking at major farms that do produce a lot of food, using pesticides and insecticides, they will produce cheaper food. But when something goes wrong, it goes terribly wrong. We'll see recalls, and you'll see costs go up significantly. Organic farming is much more stable from a costing perspective.
Okay, and Nicole Boudreau, so we also have a list of the products that have the least amount of pesticides. Avocado, sweet corn, and pineapple is at the top of that list. So do you suggest that consumers work off lists like this when they decide what to spend extra money on?
Well, it's hard to make a recommendation, but yes, if you really care to have a reduced level of pesticide on the produce, because these, like the corn, there are many layers, so maybe it protects the core of the produce from pesticide. But again, removing all the pesticides from all these fruits and vegetables is difficult because they are spread intensively as the fruit or the vegetable grows. So it becomes like incorporated inside of it. So even if you wash the surface, it's good. It's very good. There is still some pesticide. There are still some residues left inside the produce. Yeah. But, I would recommend consumers to be a little less sophisticated in their choice, you know, and it's all to buy organic fruit in the summer when they are less expensive and to keep them in your freezer. There are many, many ways to reduce pesticide exposure from your plate.
And, Sylvain, people seem reluctant to buy frozen produce, but often it's healthier, right?
I wouldn't say healthier, but you do get a good nutritional bang for your buck. And the good news, Libby, is that food prices in the frozen aisle have stabilized in recent months, so that's a good thing. Just going back to the different items that you mentioned that actually had less pesticides. I think you mentioned sweet corn, pineapple, and avocados, correct?
Those are the top three with the least, yes.
Yeah,
also asparagus, which is in season now and expensive.
Asparagus. But when you look at sweet corn, pineapple, and avocados, all three of them have a hard peel to it. So it protects the fruit. It protects the food itself from pesticides. So you want to be careful with how you interpret some of those results. But asparagus actually is a really interesting case because it is exposed to chemicals and it's done very, very well.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. I am so out of time. This is an interesting and important conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Sylvain Charlebois and Nicole Boudreau. And that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.